Let's look at 36. We won't read through the genealogy, but I just wanted to point out a couple things to you. 36 of Genesis. Obviously, this is the family, mine says the family of, or you could say that Esau was the father of the Edomites. And in the Edomites, we know that King Herod the Great was an Edomite. He was the last one of the line, right, that was pure in a sense. And then they started intermarrying and whatnot. But it's interesting anyways. And of course, Obadiah says that the Edomites would be doomed, you know. So eventually, there is no more Edomites that we know of. Also in... So you can, you know, read through the genealogy of Esau. There's some highlights, I guess, other than he's the father of the Edomites. In verse 9 there, we see the name, one of Esau's sons was Eliphaz. And if you remember in Job, Eliphaz was one of the confronters of Job. One of the friends there. A lot of people think this is the same Eliphaz that Job mentions. So if it is, that means that Job was most likely written before Genesis, and because Moses would write this, right? So. Be about 500 years prior to Genesis. It would be one of the oldest books in the Bible, even though it's in the middle. It's not chronological. Many theologians think that. That's the way it is. So there you have some. And of course, I think someplace in this genealogy it calls out a man named Jobab. And they think that was maybe perhaps Job. So you could say that Job was a contemporary of Esau and Jacob. So along those same lines there. But anyways, I'll let you read through. As Bob said, sometimes the genealogy is kind of dry, but it certainly leads us to a point, and this one happens to lead us right to Joseph. And you know, even... some parts of Genesis here, and as we'll read through this, we'll find that Genesis isn't all in order, because as we'll see, the dreams that Joseph has reveals that he is speaking his dream at one point to his mom and dad. So while we know that Rachel died previously, so she must have been alive and 37, but she died back here in 35, I think it is. So, anyways, you guys can figure it out. So, chapter 37, verse 1, says, "Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age." What was interesting, Benjamin was the son of his old age as well, right? But for whatever reason, he loved Joseph here. "Also, he made him the tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that his father loved him more than all the brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him." So here he is, 17 years old, and of course Joseph is a remarkable story. It's a remarkable story. James James Boyce commentary would say this of him. He said he was loved and hated and favored and abused, tempted and trusted, exalted and abased. Yet at one point in the 110 years life of Joseph, did he ever seem to get his eyes off God? Wouldn't that be a great thing? At no point did he get his eyes off the Lord. You know, and we know his life, right? Well, we can read it here, even in this quote here, that he was favored at one point and he was abused at one point. He was loved and he was hated. He was tempted and he was trusted. And he goes on to say, he says, adversity did not harden his character. Prosperity did not ruin him. He was the same in private as in public. He was a true great man. And of course, now you look out on the streets, right? What do you see? See a whole lot of flyers out there, you know, elect me as the next whatever. And everybody wants to proclaim a great man in the public's eyes. But in the private eye, we know that's often somewhat different. We see it in guys' lives. One of the guys that I work with, he used to work for a company up in Rochester area, and one of the one of the owners probably about 3 years ago decided that he didn't want his wife anymore, and he killed her. He said he was the nicest guy. He would come to work, he was the sales guy, you know, he was the one with the smiles and the ones that could delight people and stuff, but his outward appearance was different than his internal appearance, right? His private appearance. And so we gotta be careful. We gotta be careful that, you know, that we all have it. See, we all have our private appearance, and we always have our public appearance, right? When I walk up to you, I say, "How you doing?" And you say, "Great, just dandy," right? But you know that behind the scenes, there might be something going on, but they're not being real honest. They're too happy all the time, you know. It's good to be honest, because that makes it honest to ourselves too. We know when we shouldn't be what we are, and sometimes, and we need to get with the Lord. But if we look at the men of faith in Scripture, we'll see Noah, who, if you looked at Noah's life, you could say that he had this perseverance faith, right? He had a faith when nobody else wanted to believe in the Lord. He was willing to persevere through that, right? He was willing to forego the clamor of the crowd, right? Over the 120 years, you know, if anybody had perseverance, that man had perseverance when he went and he built the ark as everybody else clamored and chang and did all that stuff of probably mocking him. You know, I was thinking of your friend, you know, as he sits and he works, and if the guys are mocking him because of who he is, look at Noah. He was a man of perseverance and faith. For 120 years, you know. Abraham, right? Abraham, we could think of him as obedience and faith, and we see this in the way he went to the altar with his son. He didn't question the Lord. Lord, should I be doing this? Lord, you know, should I really be doing this? Or, Lord, I don't want to do this. And you throw a little temper tantrum, right? I don't want to do this. But the Lord, you know, the Lord's pricked you and you need to do it. Right? There's many things in ministry that you don't want to do. Right? Why? Because there's no profit for me. That's what I look at. I go, hey, there's no profit in it for me. Why should I be doing it? Why should we be putting effort into outreaches? There's no profit in there for us. Well, we do it because of obedience to the Lord, right? We do it because we want to obey Him. We want to be as Abraham was and in a sense, really take our lives to the altar. Take our lives to the altar and say, Lord, I want to be that, you know, that Romans 12 person, that Romans 12 man, that, Lord, that I want to be that one that is a living sacrifice for you. Then we see Isaac, and you could say he had the power of faith. when he had faith, God would provide the sacrifice for him. Right? He went willingly with his dad to that altar to be sacrificed, knowing that God was going to provide the sacrifice. Not kicking and screaming. Good example for kids here, you know. When the parents ask you to do something, I'm just kidding. No. So you shouldn't have sat in that row with this one. But it's a good example, really. It's a big kids, little kids, medium-sized kids. It's certainly a good example of how we should act with the Father, right? When he asks us to do something. Then we see Joseph, I think of him as being converted by faith, right? He finally gave in, and he went from Jacob the deceiver to Israel, God rules. He finally was converted, you know. And now we see Joseph. I don't know. But Joseph, you know, you could say that he had victory through faith. But I almost feel like you could look at Joseph and you could look at the other guys, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and you could almost say he was each one of those. You know, because he lived with perseverance, right? Let me tell you, you go from dad's house right to the pit, from the pit to a slave, from a slave to a prince. There's some cyclic motion there that you go through in a lifetime that, man, if you haven't got perseverance, you don't stick with it, right? You fall to the temptation. You don't trust the Lord. You know, but I think in obedience and just sticking with it, and you never hear him. You know, all through the Scriptures, you don't hear him really complain at all. No matter where he's at, in prison, whatever. So it's really from Joseph, you could say Joseph was, in a sense, a powerful picture to us, you know, in a lot of senses, a powerful picture of us of who Christ was and is, right? What he did when he was on the cross, he got spit at. He was God. He could have took himself off that cross, beat them guys up, and gotten out of there, right? But he didn't. So I think Joseph was one of those pictures of Christ going to the cross. You know, what an awesome thing that is. It said that Israel loved Joseph more than all of his children, and certainly, you know, favoritism amongst our family, amongst our kids, isn't a good thing. You know, that's why I don't favor. My kids, I give them cruel spankings every time. You know, I discipline them real hard, every single one of them. You know, not really. They deserve it sometimes, but I don't. But, you know, you don't favor the... You can see the disruption in the home almost right away here. You know, how disruptive this is. But do you remember Jacob's past? Do you remember Jacob's past? Right? And what happened there? And how there was favoritism with Jacob and Esau, and how mom liked, you know, Jacob better than Esau, and Esau was favored by Isaac. And well, you see that, and you see how it brews. So we got to be careful as parents what we're brewing in our kids. What are they seeing? And you know, it kind of makes me think even about me, right? I think, what do my kids see in me? What do my kids see in me? Don't answer that question, Hannah. Or Noah. Yet. I want to know, though. You know, we had one of these things at work. They're trying to change some of the culture because of the culture right now at World Kitchen. I look at it. I'm not scared, but some people are scared because we've had a lot of exiting. Right? And it seems to continue. So the CEO came in yesterday, and he said, you know what? We're changing the culture, and he's got this thing, and I believe in it. I really support him and everything. What was my point there? Oh, but one of the things that he said was, speak up. I want you to speak up. Right? So when you don't like something, I want you to come to me and tell me that I've done something wrong, right? Or you don't like how that's done, or you don't like this about the business and you think it could be done and maybe you're afraid to say what you're thinking. I'm telling you, it's okay to say that, right? And we need to say that to our kids. Tell us the honest truth. So what's wrong with this boy? You know? Like I said, Noah, not now. Well, you'll have your turn. We got, 11 days vacation. Come on up here. We'll figure it out. It'll probably just put a mark in it, right? But we need to be careful what we're teaching our kids and favoritism there. Said he also made him a tunic of many colors. And and then it goes on to say that the brothers hated him, right? But he gave him this tunic, and this tunic wasn't necessarily just, you know, there's many speculations. Was it really of many colors and all this? But what it really meant was that it was of royalty. You know, so if you're a working man, you would have short sleeves, and if you're a man that is of royalty, you would have longer sleeves, and that was that's what Jacob did here with Joseph, is that he gave him this outward display, right, to his son, that he said, hey, you're my favorite, right? And so it. To the other guys, if you've ever had that happen to you, I don't know if you did as a kid, but I was kind of like that. My dad loved my sister, and I felt like he didn't love me as much, right? And my mom loved me, and didn't love my sister as much. That's how it came across. Now, I'm not saying that was true, but that's how it was. How it came across to me, just because of outward appearance things that happened, right? The way they treated us and stuff. So we got to be careful, even amongst ourselves, you know? Church becomes very cliquish. So we got to be careful when somebody's here that's new, that we don't become, hey, how's it going? How's them bills going? And we're in this conversation amongst ourselves, and all of a sudden we've just kind of alienated the guest, you know, the person that's visiting for the first time. I would like to say that, for the most part, a lot of people that come here, that even if they're here once, right, I hear it a lot. Hey, you know, folks are pretty friendly here. And that's good. We want to keep it that way, right? We want to keep it that way. We want to make sure that they don't feel like they're left out. But here it signifies a position of favor, almost as in the birthright, right? Almost like, even though he was one of the youngest, he was the one of his old age, right, it said, that they felt like, hey, you know what? He's going to get the privilege of the older one. So there becomes this defense. And it says they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Verse 5. Now Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, please hear the dream which I have dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaf stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. And his brothers said to him, shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Interesting here, it says that, you know, now Joseph had a dream, right? And he told it to his brother. It doesn't tell us right there that what the dream was. But then it seems like there was another dream. And it starts telling us about that. And he wanted to tell him that. But couldn't he tell that they were angry? right? That they're a little upset with him for telling them the first one, right? But it's hard to tell if he understood all of that, but it seemed like it would be a visible thing. He was hated for the coat. He's now hated for the first dream, and now he's going to tell him the second dream. It was almost as if he knew the ending, and it was, and perhaps he liked the ending. He liked how this story goes. You know, you always tell a good story, don't you? You always tell a good story that reflects your goodness or reflects maybe your promotion in life, right? I accomplished this, this, and this so that I could achieve this. And so he wanted to tell them, hey, this is my dream. And certainly, as we know, it was prophetic, right? Because we look at this and we say, well, wait a minute, what are they doing here? It's the sheaves in the field, which are the bundles of wheat, and that's food. And so later on, of course, he was over. Potiphar gave him over all the food there, right? And he was able to distribute, or Pharaoh was, and he was able to distribute it, right? And so, yeah, was it prophetic? Was it true? Yeah. But we got to be careful, too. You know, we have to be careful about how we say things to folks, right? Though we want to speak the truth. But there are certain times when I think sometimes the Lord would have us to, he gives us something just for us to know. And that's it. We don't need to go telling everybody about it. He just gave it to us to know. You know? And of course they said, shall you reign over us? You know, the brothers knew the dream. They could understand it. They could figure it out. And of course, we know that one day that would happen. And it was relevant. It was relevant to the position in which Joseph would ultimately have for his, you know, in Egypt there. Verse 9. Then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, look, I have dreamed another dream. And this time the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bowed down to me. So he told it to his father and his brothers. And his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you? And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. So here he goes again. He would tell him another dream. He's certainly adding up the chips against them. He'd tell this dream, and of course it predicted that he would be above his brothers as well as his mother and his father. You know, sometimes we like Joseph, right? We like it. I guess we like his coat or something. But here it doesn't seem like he was doing necessarily the proper thing. He wasn't. He was kind of instigating in a sense. He knew that the dream wouldn't have been popular to him as well, right? If the table was turned, it wouldn't have been popular to him. And we should kind of look at things like this and say, hey, you know, if we'd like to be treated this way, then we want others to be treated this way. We don't like to be treated that way, well, we probably shouldn't do that, right? This whole instigating of... And you could say here that perhaps Joseph had experienced some pride that had entered in, and he was enamored by what the Lord was showing him about his future, and that he lost sight of his audience, he lost sight of his brothers, and sometimes we do. We lose sight of other people's and how they feel. You know, and how we should, you know, and I think of Peter, right? Peter lost sight of his audience. He lost sight that he had 600 folks in front of him that were armed with clubs and swords. He lost sight of that. And he also lost sight that they were part of the multitude that Jesus had taught in the temple, right? And then he cut their ears off, or one of their ears off. And sometimes we lose sight, you know, when we're witnessing to somebody, when we're out there trying to witness to them, you know what I usually do? I let them tell me their story first. I ask them a couple of questions to get them going. And I allow them to speak to me first. What do you think about God? And just let them go on. They might rattle on some stuff that's, I mean, I heard some things out here this Monday that, you know, I'm standing there just kind of cringing, in a sense, as people telling me about who he is, you know. They had no clue, of course, and what the Bible and what the Scriptures say about him. And eventually I'd get there with them, but it would take me a while because I had to do it with sensitivity too, right? Because I tell you guys, their normality is that life. That's normality to them, right? It's not normal to us. Shacking up with people, having multiple fathers, that's abnormal to us, and it should be, right? But it's not abnormal to them, right? So if you went up to somebody and said, hey, you know, and offended them, guess how much witness opportunity you'd have? None. Just make sure you give them the word, right? Because the word offends, and that's the way it is. Let your words be his words, right? So let the Lord offend them. But we got to be careful. We got to be careful how we approach people, you know. Sometimes I think, you know, in Joseph's case here, I think he got a little prideful and perhaps thinking of himself, thinking of his position that he was, his father had set him in. And in our case, the position in which the Lord has set you in, we can get a little prideful. You know, I tell JP, you know, one of the tough things about being a worship leader is that you can get prideful in it. Right? You can get prideful in worship. You can get prideful in a gift that the Lord has given you. And all of a sudden, it's all about you. And it's about not about him, and it's not about anybody else, it's just about you. And I'm sure you've seen that before in worship leaders, right? Where it's, hey, that, you know, Satan was a worship leader, so, you know, Lucifer was there. He got prideful, he wanted the position of God, right? But we can get prideful in our gifts that the Lord provides for us. Not because we deserve them, but because he's gracious and wonderful. But I would encourage us to be other-centered. You know, think about others before ourselves. And like I said before, sometimes the Lord would show us something, whether it's in dreams or, you know, hopefully in his word, he shows you things day in and day out. And sometimes he just wants you to keep them to yourself. I'm all in favor of putting stuff up on the internet and Facebook and stuff. Sometimes the Lord just gives you that token and says, I want you to keep this. I want you to keep it for you. For you. Right? Verse 12. Then his brothers went to feed their father's sheep in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, Are not your brothers feeding the sheep in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. So he said to him, Here I am. Sound familiar? Here I am, Lord. Then he said to him, Go up and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks. And bring back word to me. So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. And the next, and a certain man found him, and there he was, wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, "What are you seeking?" So he said, "I am seeking my brother. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks." And the man said, "They have departed from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. So there's nothing really big and revealing here, I don't think. There probably is, I just haven't found it yet. But the one thing that you do see is Shechem. It's a place where the brothers are, and of course that is the place in which Jacob had went and stayed, right? Remember when the Lord had told him to go back to his father's land, he got partway there and he decided to hang out there, and that's exactly where the brothers here are. And it's certainly a reminder of the influence that the world has on us. You know, as we find a place that we like and we want to settle down in, do we settle down there because it's the Lord or because our flesh likes it, you know? But just a reminder. But he sends Joseph into them to find out, you know, how are they doing? It might seem like a good intention, but it always seems like he's encouraging perhaps some bad behavior, you know, of telling on his brothers and whatnot, and that whole tattletale kind of thing that happens. But verse 18, now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. And they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit. And we shall say, 'Some wild beast has devoured him.' We shall see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out from their hand and said, "Let us not kill him." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, but cast him into the pit which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that they might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father." So a couple things here. As they saw him approach, what did they call him? They called him the dreamer, you know, almost a kind of a ridicule of him. It isn't hard to see what they thought of him here. They see, he says, we shall see what will become of his dreams. So in a sense, they said, if those dreams are real, if they're really from God, God will make something of them, in a sense. Right? If we kill him, let's see what happens to his dreams. Right? And of course, Reuben would talk him out of it. But you know, sometimes when life hits us with a ton of bricks and we get in a bad situation, we get kind of bummed out, right? Which is kind of normal. But the Lord's in control, right? Can he move mountains? He can, right? Can he do the impossible? Yeah, he can do that as well, right? But when we get in a sticky situation, we say, "Lord, how are you ever going to get me there where you promise?" You know, me and Don were talking about his promises. His promises are always true, right? Because if we think about Joseph and his life and how cyclic it was and how he went through these bad times and these good times and these bad times and these good times, and we think, wait a minute, how is God ever going to work out his plan? If we were just looking at Joseph's life and it looked like the wave on the ocean. How is God ever going to work out His plan of salvation? Isn't He supposed to come through Judah? Wait a minute. If you get Him mad at his brothers, and He allows His brothers to starve to death because of the famine, well, Lord, what happens to Judah? Are you going to come through the line of Judah? Well, see, the Lord works it all out, right? As we know, because we have the whole book, right? And we're able to see it. We can determine it now. But when you're in that situation, boy, it's hard to see some of that stuff. Right? Right, Chris? It's like, I'm not liking my job right now. Right? Things are turning rough. They're giving me bad hours. But the Lord has it all worked out. He's got the period and the sentence, right? He's wrote the last chapter, and we know the end of the story, and we win, right? And we see Reuben, you know, Reuben the hero here. He's the one member back in, I think, chapter 35. He's the one that had some bad relations with his father's wives, right? One of his wives. That he shouldn't have had. And he lost his birthright card, in a sense. Right? We know that later on, I think in chapter 49, we find out that he wasn't rewarded. He was disciplined for that. And so, here he comes. He steps in and he's the hero here. He pulls him out of the pit. They're not going to kill him. They're not going to kill him. But look at it. It says, but Reuben heard it and he delivered him out of the hands. And he said, let us not kill him. Well, and it says, shed no blood, but cast him into the pit. Right? So he didn't want to shed the blood, but he just cast him into the pit. What he should have said was, you guys are wrong. You guys are wrong for hating this boy. Right? I mean, if you think about it, does God have a right, because of our sin, to hate us? He does, right? He didn't have to be merciful, but it's part of who He is. Right? But what He should have said was, you guys are wrong. He should have stepped up to the plate, and yes, He should have diverted His death, but He also shouldn't have threw him in the pit. What's worse, throw him in the pit or kill him? Because if they left him in the pit, he would have died, right? So it came to pass in verse 23, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. And then they took him and cast him into the pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. So you know it's just a matter of days, especially out in the desert. And they sat down to eat a meal. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, what profit is there to kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him. For he is our brother in our flesh. And his brothers listened, and the Midianite traders passed by. So the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. So the first thing they did was they took this tunic that his father had given him, the one that showed the favoritism, right? That showed the favoritism. They took the coat off him right away. It says they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that he that was on him. And you got to believe it was somewhat pleasurable for them to do that, right? And then they sat down and they ate a nice meal, knowing that now the brother was in the pit and they still were able to eat. Something about this, you know, it's just a... You can see the hatred, what hatred does to us, right? Our motives change with it. Our personalities change. We start doing things perhaps that we didn't intend to ever do. You know, nobody sets out to be a murderer. Let's face it, you know, the little boy that, you know, Karen's brother when he was a little boy wanted to be a garbage truck. You know, that's what little boys want to be. They want to be something that's, you know, different usually. But he wanted to be a garbage truck. Never set out to be a murderer, though. Right? Nobody does. He never became a murderer, by the way. So you don't have to worry when he comes to church again. But we don't set out that way. But it happens because we allow sin. We allow the bondage of sin in our lives. We don't take care of it. We continue to live with it. It's just like a garden, right? If you take care of a garden, it'll produce some good fruit, right? If you don't take care of a garden, it'll produce some good weeds and choke out the plants that have the good fruit. But hatred stirs up a real bad heart. If you want to turn to... I just want to show you this one verse. Genesis 42. Of course, we'll get there very soon. Verse 21 says, speaking of them, "Then they said to one another, 'We are truly guilty concerning our brother.'" They were confessing. "For we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and they would not hear. Then before this distress has come upon us." And so, you know, Joseph's brothers would go to Egypt to get food. They would confess this to Joseph, that, you know, they had turned on their brothers. But this was some time after this. Matter of fact, Barnhouse would say this. He says a physicist could compute the exact time required for his crying, speaking of Joseph, right, to go 25 yards to the eardrums of his brother. But it took 22 years for that cry to go from the eardrums to their heart. Even though they heard the cry of their brother in the pit, saying, it took them 22 years to get to the point where they were sorry that they did what they did. Right? It took famine in their lives, right, to drive them to a point where they were able to say, hey, you know, what I did wasn't right. I'm a sinner. I was talking to a guy out here on Monday night, and he had heard the gospel before I could tell. You know, when I was sharing with him that he knew it, and I think his wife was saved and he wasn't. And of course, that's always a tough situation, right? A marriage like that. And so, as I was continuing on with him, I said, "Well, tell me why. What happened to you? Because you're kind of limping, right?" He had a limp, and he was probably 30 years old. He said, "Well, about 3 weeks ago, I fell out of a tree. I fell 25 feet, and I landed on my feet." And he says, "I already got bad knees and a bad hip, and he said, I got to have an operation on my knees and have replacements put in, and then I just messed them up even more." He looked kind of like a football player, so I don't know if he played football at one time, messed up his knees kind of thing. But I said, that's interesting. What do you think about falling out of a tree? Wouldn't want to do it again. I said, yeah, but have you ever thought maybe you could land in your head? He goes, yeah, I did think about that. It makes you think a lot. And I said, have you ever thought about eternal life? Have you ever thought about if you died today, if you'd go to heaven, if you'd go to hell? And he said, yeah, I thought about that. You know, and he knew it. He wasn't convinced yet, you know. He just wasn't convinced. You know, I talked to him for quite a while, and, you know, it was pretty cordial, and he was willing to listen and stuff. He just wasn't there yet, you know. But sometimes God brings famine in your life. He brings a time of suffering. He brings us to our knees where we say, you know what, we're helpless, Lord. We're helpless and we need you. But I was thinking, so hatred, you know, stirs up a real bad heart. And I was thinking even just about criminals, right? I remember this guy in Naples, I don't know, probably 6-7 years ago, drove his wife up there and decided to put the van in neutral and let it roll down the hill. And she died. And, of course, he went around and said, It was a fluke, you know. Something happened to the van, did something, and it fell down the hill. Well, yeah, when you don't put it in gear and you give it a little push, right? But see how wicked the heart is? We come to a spot where we're not even in reality. When hatred enters into the heart, and all of a sudden we're kind of like, you know, we just got a bad heart, and it ain't convincing us that we're sinners anymore. What's bad and what's good, you know? What's evil and what's not? His brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. What does that remind you of? I think we just mentioned that here a week or so ago, where we talked about how Judas sold the Lord for 30 pieces, right? Not 20, but 30, very similar to that betrayal. Verse 29, and then Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes, and he turned to his brothers and said, the lad is no more, and I, where shall I go? So he took Joseph's tunic, killed the kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they set the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, we have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not? And he recognized it and said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn in pieces. Then Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his waist and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him. But he refused to be comforted. And he said, for I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning. Thus the father wept for him. They covered their sin. First of all, they covered their sin with a lie, right? And that is usually how it goes, right? We cover our sins with our lie. Why did you do that? And all of a sudden, all the excuses come, right? All the excuses come. Said Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes, and of course that was an expression of sadness or sorrow or horror or however you want to express that. But, you know, I think Reuben, maybe second thought, you know, give him the benefit of the doubt here, maybe he was second thinking his reaction back here in 21, where he would say that he would put him in the pit rather than kill him. You know, and he was thinking, well, maybe I should have stood up for what was right. Maybe I shouldn't have allowed this to happen. You know, as he saw the empty pit, perhaps he thought the worst, right? That he should have stood up for him. And, you know, for Jacob, he might as well have been dead, right? Because he experienced the death of his son, whether it was real or not. And that's how it is sometimes, you know, as Jacob tore his clothes for the expression of grief for his son there. We see the deceiver, Jacob. Now God rules in his life, Israel. But he sees some of the repercussion here of his deception through the ages. And now we see him being deceived. He believes that his son is dead. And like I said, to this point, it probably doesn't matter whether it's true or not. He's going to experience the same emotions. And I think sometimes that's how the enemy works too. The enemy convinces us that we're not good enough to be forgiven. Things happen in our life and the enemy comes along and convinces us that it's our fault, that God doesn't love us anymore. And the circumstances seem to get worse and worse. And we start thinking, well, maybe God doesn't love me. And pretty soon we've convinced ourselves of something that's not true. We've fallen out of fellowship with the Lord because now we really believe, even though it's not true, we really believe that He doesn't love us. And we start to not read our Word, you know, and fellowship with Him. We fall out of fellowship. We've seen it with people, right? Where they fall out of fellowship with the saints and no longer do they call you or no longer do you see them anymore. But they start to believe the hopelessness of the enemy, that we're hopeless. And even though it's not true, might as well be true, because we certainly feel that way. And there were some honest feelings. I think we could all say that we've been through that, where we've had those kind of down in the dumps spiritual journeys, you know, where we've felt like the Lord doesn't love us anymore. But it's just the enemy trying to get to us, trying to be effective in our lives, right, to divert us from the plan of the Lord. The Lord has a way of getting us back, though. As a way, He sends people back into our lives. You know, sometimes we bump into people that we don't want to bump into at the time, right? Misery likes company rather than the other way around, right? But in 36 it says, now the Midianites had sold him to Egypt, to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. So now he goes from the pit to being sold. And being sold, he goes to Potiphar. And now he's, in a sense, it looks as if he is going to Potiphar to be a slave. F.B. Myers would say, Though stripped of his coat, he had not been stripped of his character. Even though he was brought into Egypt as a slave, he still remained God's. Right? He wasn't stripped of that. Even though we're in the pit, we're not stripped of our relationship with Christ. Even though life situations don't seem very delightful at times, we're not stripped of our relationship with Christ. Right? Circumstances don't make a relationship with Christ. But what a gift, you know. Here's a gift to Egypt. Egypt needs a gift right now, don't they? They need a Joseph right now. I took you through the plan. It's amazing how God works. You know, He uses this young man, 17 years old, and he gives him dreams, and the dreams it brings about, obviously, hatred and favoritism would bring around hatred, and maybe the dreams cultivated the hatred, and you would say, why, Lord, why did you send him dreams? Didn't you know that was going to stir things up? And he said, yeah, I knew it was going to stir things up. I needed to get him to Egypt, right? I needed to stir him up so I could get him to Egypt. Right? I think of you guys here that bought the houses, right, where I know how you probably feel sometimes. You probably think, well, why did we move into the city more? And the neighborhood's tough, and it's a tough neighborhood, but God had to get you here. Had to get you here so He could use you. And we see His whole journey, right? And we'll talk about it a little later in Genesis there where, he's chased by a woman of Potiphar and his wife and then thrown in jail. And then he interprets dreams and so forth and is appointed prime minister there of Egypt. And, it goes on, and then he's head over all the food, and of course his family comes into Egypt, and he feeds them, and he secures the line of Judah, and then the line of Judah would bring forth the Messiah, and the Messiah would die upon the cross, and the Messiah would rise again and show us that He had victory over sin and death. And what a marvelous story, right? So when we look at somebody and we say, wow, I don't know if there's hope for them. There's hope for them, right? They can go through all life's circumstances. They can go through, all the difficulties of this life, and it might be difficult. But God can still use them, right? God can work it all out. There's been many, if you guys want to read I can't even remember what it's called, but it's a Calvary, I call it the Calvary Pastor's Book. It's about all the different Calvaries, all the different pastors that came out of the hippie movement out of California. One of them was Pastor Bill, and Mike McIntosh, and they were loaded upon with LSD and whatnot, and the Lord saved them. There's some miracles in that book, Was it Rawls Reese that went in his house? He was going to kill his wife. And he went in the house and he pulled the gun up and bam! Nothing. Didn't kill her. Didn't shoot her. Didn't know what happened. Craziness, And it was, God does things. God uses the foolish, right, to confound the wise, right? So it's kind of, you guys are a bunch of fools. It's going to use you, right?